It's good history that God has led us into. So what do I mean by history? Because we all have history. Why am I stressing it that way? Well, history, let me suggest to you this morning, history is the record, the story, the events, everything that's occurred, both now and in the future, in this mystical way between God's will and your will and the will of others. Let me repeat that. History, stressing his. History is the record, the story, the events that have transpired in a mystical way, now and into the future, between God's will and your will and the will of others. Let me express it the way David wrote about it. Because David wrote in Psalm 139 about his history. What was David's history? Well, David wrote this. Wonderful psalmist, incredible poet. He said, "For you, God, created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when you knit me together in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God." David had an understanding of what his history was, that God's will and his will and the will of others intermingled in a fascinating way. But of course, when we tell our histories, which we do all the time, when we have our fellowship time after the service, you will tell part of your history. You'll tell someone something that went on this week or something that's coming up. And I challenge you to think, okay, which is God's will? Which is your will? And which is the will of others in that incredible dynamic? We express it in various ways. When I was a financial planner, I heard people say to me about their wealth, "I'm a self-made man. I'm a self-made woman." And I just had to think, no, you're not. Tell me your mother's name. You're not self-made. I've had other people say, "Well, you know, the devil made me do it." And I thought, no, he didn't. You did that all by yourself. I've had people as well say to me, you know, "God has not really rewarded me the way I deserve." To which, the thought is often, I think he's given you way more than you deserve. You see, the part of the challenge that we have with history, with telling our stories to each other, day by day as we do them, is we misappropriate. We blame God for things that he has no part of. We blame others for things that we're responsible for, and we take credit at times on the negative side. But don't be discouraged about that. Don't say, okay, fine, Ken, I'm never going to tell my story again. I'm going to live somewhere remote with no one around. That's not the answer. You have history. You have stories to tell. In fact, God blesses others by you telling your story to them. I was blessed this week in meeting one of our members for lunch and being blessed by their story. It's a blessing to each other. It's one of the ways you're a witness is to tell the stories. The challenge is for us to tell them accurately. Jesus, son of David, like biologically and by name, and by God's design. Jesus, son of David, told a lot of stories. He told, as we talked about last week, he told once upon a time stories. We call it Christmas. He told it was the best of times, it was the worst of times stories. We tend to think that's Easter for him. And he told what we talked about last today, the someday soon stories, which are your hopes, your dreams. Someday soon I'm going to do this. When Jesus told this story, he too had a history, a will of God in his life, his own will. He said, I pick up and lay down my life of my own will and the will of others. An incredible mix of things. Jesus told these stories, but he did it in an incredible way because he wanted to communicate to us. So he told stories. He told stories to us. In fact, he told 46 stories to us. And we've been looking at, we're going to look at these last three that he told. Significant parables found in Matthew 25, if you want to look it up in your Bibles. Matthew 25 has three parables. The parable that we considered last week was the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. So Rob and Kim are with us today. They're going to be married in a month. And I hope the bridesmaids in Matthew 25 are not your bridesmaids, Kim, because they forgot all about what they were doing. They didn't bring them what they needed. They didn't bring the oil, the hairspray, the clips. They didn't bring the dresses. They forgot. Five of them did. So Matthew 25 has another story that Jesus tells. This is also an incredible story, and as we look at it next week, the third story, we'll see how they knit together, because Jesus is telling something significant for your future in these three stories. He's telling these three stories, and I've asked Tran to come and read this for us. So Tran, if you'll come up, and we're going to read Matthew 25, 14 to 30. This is what's called the parable of the talents. And some of you, of course, are familiar with this, but I've asked Tran to read this for us.
Matthew 25, line 14 to 30, the parable of the bags of gold. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more, but the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. Yes, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things, and I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. Yes, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not scattered the seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belonged to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant, so you knew that I have harvest where I have not sown and gathered where I have not scattered the seed. Well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I return, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags, for whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
What are your questions? Any questions that come up in this text? Why is the third servant called wicked? What would have happened if the first two servants had lost it all? The third master is really wanting to protect his master's wealth. Okay. Isn't the third servant also protecting his master's wealth? Okay, let's go with those questions. Let me just repeat them again. Number one, what would have happened if the first and second servant had lost it all? Obviously, invested it, put it to work. Why is the third servant called wicked? He was just protecting his servant's money, his master's money. And isn't it unreasonable that the one with 10 gets 11? given more. This statement where we see, give it to the one who has, for the one who has will be given more, and the one who does not have will be taken away. That's an unreasonable statement. You could say, okay, let's tackle this parable. It's an incredible parable. I have heard this parable terribly mistranslated. What do we know for sure? Well, first thing we know for sure is Jesus has a context, a reason why he's telling this story. What's the reason? Why is he telling this story? Well, verse 14 and back to verse 1 and back to chapter 24, he's talking about when he comes back. He's giving his disciples a picture of this is what's going to happen. This is my expectations. It will be like, what will be like? The kingdom of God will be like. What's the kingdom of God? His return. That's what he's talking about. These are real events in our future. They're coming. You're going to see them. Guaranteed. Everybody will see them. Next is, this is a business analogy. Last week we looked at a marriage analogy. One of the most profound things in Jewish life at the time, marriage. Well, now Jesus is taking another profound meaning that impacts all of us, and that is the family business. He's talking about his master's wealth. He's using a business analogy. Here's an entrepreneur. Here's a man, the master. And who is the man? Who is the man? Who is the master? It's Jesus. Jesus is the master. What's fascinating is there's another 12 parables that are about finances. Oftentimes when Jesus tells a parable about finances, he says, God is the master. Here he says, I'm the master. In the other parables that Jesus tells in this parable here, who are the servants? His followers, the ones who do his will. It's you and I. We're in this parable. It's a timeless parable. It's his church. What is the gold? Well, the translator for the NIV says bags of gold. But of course, bags of gold becomes problematic because if I have a Ziploc of gold, it's far different than if I have a suitcase of gold. Both can be called bags. In many translations, it's a talent of gold. Jesus used the words talent. What's a talent? A talent is like pounds sterling. In Jesus' day, a talent was a measurement of weight and currency. You could pay people in currency, but the currency was by weight too, like pounds sterling. What was its value? Well, one talent was worth 15 years of a laborer's wages. One talent was 75 pounds. If you have 75 pounds of gold today at the gold price of a little under $1,500, you would have $1.6 million in one talent. Go to work tomorrow and say, can you pay me in talents? Not concrete pounds, but gold pounds. Silver pounds. Just pay me in talents. Wouldn't that be awesome? He's talking about something seriously significant. $1.6 million for the one who got one talent. Third thing we know, or the fourth thing we know, is that the master knows the servant's abilities, verse 15. He knows what they can do. Each according to their ability. He gives it out to the ones, each according to their ability. He entrusts the wealth, but the full expectation of all three of them is the master's coming back and he expects an accounting. There's a settling update coming. It's not been handed over to them to say, oh, go and do whatever you want with it. All of them have a safe option. And that's to take it back to the Royal Bank of Canada and invest it there. And that's a legitimate option. Why didn't you? The master says, put it on loan with the bankers. At least I would have had it with interest. It's a legitimate option. And all of them have the assumption that the master is hard-dealing businessman. The third one is the one that says this. I knew, verse 24, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you had not sown and gathering where you had not scattered seed. Reputation is this is a hard man in terms of business. But it's falsely assumed. The other thing we know for sure is that the first two double it, and they're rewarded. If you've been in business for a long time, you know that doubling your wealth isn't really all that significant. Shepherds at the time could double their wealth in 1 year. A grove could be doubled in 5 years. Even today in business, 5 to 7 years is when you'd want it to be paid off, when it would double. What is Jesus in part saying? Well, they doubled it. They didn't do 100-fold, which you would get if you planted a seed in the ground. Just doubled it. And they're rewarded for it. In fact, they're rewarded so much that it said this of them, of the first two. Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things, just a couple million. Now come and share many. Come enjoy your master's happiness. And as you said too, the lazy, foolish servant is fired. We know that for sure. So some of the questions. It's a great question to ask. What would have happened if the first and second had lost their money? Because clearly they have two legitimate options. They can put it at loan with the bankers, or they can use it to grow the business of the master, which, as if you've been in business before or know people in business, you know there's potential of loss in every business. And it says that they went and invested it. They went and made it work. Put their money to work and gain five more. What's interesting, and one of the questions that I had, is what does the gold mean? What does the gold mean? So for the servants, let's take a look at the question, what does the gold mean? First of all, the servants are given the gold. They're given the gold, and it's not their own. The master wants it back. The servants are given the gold, but what they do with it, they're responsible for. You see where the credit lies? It's not in receiving the gift, it's what you do with it. Okay? So that's what's expected of them. What they do with it is the credit. There is a settling up coming. The master is going to return, verse 33 and 39. And he will ask, have you buried it, blown it, loaned it, or grown it? The gold, what is it? Well, the word talents has had an interesting history as it's become part of our English language. What is a talent? Well, a talent, according to the dictionary, is an unusual, natural ability to do something well. Typically in arts or sports, it's applied, but it can be developed with training. So the first thing that we understand from an English language point of view is talents are things that we're given that are natural abilities that we can develop with training. All of us have various understandings of how talents work. But what Jesus does in a brilliant way is he actually teaches us two things at the same time. The gold is everything the master gives us. You are the gold. God has given you yourself. So it's life and all that it entails. But there's a deeper level. Jesus is talking to his disciples. He's teaching his disciples. And he gives them gold. What is the gold that Christ gives his disciples? Teaching, grace, promises, presence, and power of the Spirit, and spiritual gifts. Okay? Think about it. Jesus is probably sitting close to the temple. And he's sharing this parable with them. And to his disciples, he shares this parable. And he is in the midst of giving to them teaching, grace, promises, presence, and power of the Holy Spirit, and spiritual gifts. But it's not just in what Jesus is doing, it's how he's acting it out. So Jesus, over the next few days, will take the greatest political power ever. He'll take the greatest wealth-building skills. He'll take the strongest divinely connected relationship ever in history, either in potential or demonstrated form. Imagine the fishermen that were in the number of, were in the 7,000 people who received his blessing when he prayed. He reproduced bread and fish for thousands. Jesus had this huge potential. And in 3 days, he'll trade this incomparable wealth for salvation of his disciples, in fact, for all of humanity whom he loves. So Jesus is living out this parable. In fact, Jesus is both the servant and the master at the same time. Jesus is God's servant. What is he doing? He's taken the gold that's given to him, and in 2 days' time, he'll die. Why is he doing that? Isn't he an unfaithful servant? Giving it all up like that? No, he's making the greatest transaction ever. Because with everything that Jesus Christ has, he's buying salvation for billions. And we see after his resurrection that he becomes the master. He's done so well under God's authority, which he has the freedom to do what he wants into, that he becomes the master. And that's what he's talking about. Jesus Christ paid everything he had. He laid it all down. Teaching grace, promises, presence and power, the Spirit, his spiritual gifts, his body. He intends and commands his disciples, servants, witnesses to take love in words and works to the whole world, to other people whom he has bought salvation for. And that's me. And that's you. He's commanding his disciples almost 2,000 years ago to keep being about his master's business so that all of you would have the option of being able to be in the kingdom. That's the master's business. So, the servants who expand the master's kingdom, the master's business, receive an incomparable reward. And as was mentioned earlier, the master is assumed to be a hard man in business. In fact, he's the reverse. That's the assumption. But when the servant with five bags comes and says, or five talents, he comes and gives five more talents, he gives them back to the master. And later in the parable, it says, take the bag of gold from him, this is 28, and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Something has happened that the servants have so delighted their master that they're no longer servants, they're sharing the inheritance. They're like sons. This master is not hard driving. He's one of the most benevolent masters ever. If you're in business, just think about your employees and say, are you ready to give them the business? Have they done enough that you could say, you know what, this is yours now? The servant who buries the priceless wealth commits the greatest sin. He rejects God's gift and spirit. He misappropriates the master's command, master's character. And as Craig said, he's a lazy sloth for a long time, even though he lives in fear. The question has to be asked, is this really a servant or is he an enemy? What's the point? Well, clearly, God loves you. He's given you his grace. He's given you you. He's given you all the blessings in this life that you would call your own. They belong to him, actually. He's the one that gave them to you. He believes in you so much that he actually gives you priceless treasure. You. He gives you the authority over yourself because he believes that you can do it. That's how much confidence he has, and he leaves. He gives you priceless treasures. At the first level, it's been understood for a long time that what you're to do is to maximize who you are, to be the best you can be. Motto of the U.S. Marines, be all you can be. This parable echoes of that. So, Charles Wesley, who was one great songwriter, he had a perspective that was like this. You're to earn all you can. Attain all you can. Retain all you can. Live most efficiently with your money. And give away all that you can. Attain, retain, and sustain others. That sounds a lot like this parable. Andrew Carnegie came along in the early part of the 20th century and said, he who dies with wealth dies in shame. Brilliant. Use it up before you go. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have established the Giving Pledge. I don't know if you've heard about this. Maybe you're part of this club. But billionaires get together. Billionaires get together. And the Giving Pledge is an invitation to the world's wealthiest individuals and families to give a majority of their wealth to philanthropy before they die. Giving Pledge. As of this January, 128 billionaires have signed a pledge that they'll give away half of their wealth before they die. Joan and Sanford Weill, he was the CEO of Citigroup. This is one of a quote from the Weills. "We will give away all the wealth we've been so fortunate to have made, except for a very small percentage that we'll give to our children and grandchildren between now and the time we pass. We are firm believers that shrouds don't have pockets." It's one of the big reasons why you should have a will. Even if it's on a blank piece of paper that you've written out, because you have something to give to the next generation. And if you don't direct it for them, you're leaving something on the table. The Wiles said, shrouds don't have pockets. They went on to say, philanthropy is much more than just writing a check. It's donating your time and energy and experience and intellect. You see, the Wiles get it. You only have a short time to use the incredible wealth that you are in this world, and to use it for the benefit of yourself and others. You are God's gold. You really are, either in potential or demonstrated form. But many billionaires miss out on what you understand. Ready for it? Many billionaires set up charitable endeavors to give away billions of dollars, and they don't do it in love. And Jesus Christ directs us that if you're not going to do what you do in love, it's a waste. Love is the paramount motivator for what we should be doing. The prime meaning for charity, caritas in Latin, is Christian love representing God's love of man, man's love of God, or man's love of his fellow man. Next time you hear the word charity, remember that this is what it means. It means Christian love representing God's love in man, man's love in God, or man's love for his fellow man. Charity actually means love. You are potential or actualized eternal wealth of talent and family and influence and power and experience and assets and wisdom and reputation. And Christ gives to you his teaching and his grace and his promises, the presence of the presence and power of the Spirit, and spiritual gifts. What does he want you to do? He wants you to pursue the good of others in love. You're invited to invest in the Master's kingdom, his business, ultimately so that what you do, how it's done, the way you say it, is in a way that God's salvation reaches them. God's message of salvation. That's your gold. I'll put it another way. Is there at least one other person who is closer to God, knows him more fully, knows Christ's salvation more deeply because of your life, that anticipates his coming? If there is, your reward is coming. In a moment, I'll ask you if there's any reflections or applications that you want to share yourselves. We look at this wicked servant, though, the one who's called the wicked servant. Tragedy that Jesus is saying, and he's giving you incredible wealth. You know, it's kind of like, I don't want to use the word, but he's serious about how much you're worth. He's serious about it. You're worth incredible amounts to him. You're worth so much to him. So for you to then say, it really doesn't matter. I'm going to sit on it and do nothing with it and bury it in the ground for my whole life. Are you not standing in the way of the Lord who wants to love others? Fascinating the way Jesus presents this, because think of how God is represented in our world. Some people, I've had times in which I think God is so hard on us that I'll never be able to please him. God knows fully about me. How can I ever do anything that accomplishes anything good to him? So part of the understanding is that God is so hard on us that there's nothing good we produce. He's in part saying, this is what you think about God's character. And in fact, in an incredible way, God is so graceful to us that he's actually offered us an opportunity to stand before him. That's a pretty generous master. Big question at the end of this. When the master judges the servant. And this statement, throw that worthless servant outside. In fact, you could define them as God's enemy, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus is speaking about, as we talked about last time, he is coming again. And he's coming at least twice. There will be a time in which he receives his church back. And most theologians think this is what he's talking about. So when we think about weeping and gnashing of teeth, is that the last chance this person's ever going to have to go to heaven? Most theologians say no. They will still have an opportunity before Jesus comes as final judge, as final arbiter. And this is what Jesus is saying, is if you're going to do nothing with all I've given you, you don't understand how valuable you are to me and how much I love those around you. Go love. We all have histories. All of us have histories. One of the things that when I was looking at this parable, I was realizing that Jesus teaches this parable, but he gives us any time to respond back to him. He looks at our heart, not the measurement of all the stuff we do. In fact, the doubling of it is an indication of that. He's not looking for a thousandfold. He's looking for us to just respond to him. So the thief on the cross, what did he have? He's a criminal. He's being killed. And Jesus says, well, today you're going to be the first one in paradise. What did he do? He simply demonstrated his faith, his goal to the master, and Jesus received him. That's a pretty gracious God. We all have histories. We all have stories that we tell. And this parable is brilliant from the point of view that Jesus is saying to us, you're worth much more than anything else in creation. I simply want to bless those around you by having you share your blessing with them. We have once upon a time stories, best of times and worst of time stories. We have a one day soon story, which Jesus talks about here, all intricately woven into God's plan. So as you expect his return, that's going to happen. As you think about your life, please don't feel overwhelmingly guilty. The fact that, oh, I haven't done anything for God. Forget the past. Let's focus on the future and what God does call you to do. In relationship with him is how he evaluates it. Hope for it. Pray we're all ready when he comes. And be wise today about what you call yours. Because in 100 years, who's it going to be with? Not you.